Good morning. This is the Lou Rockwell Show, and as always, it's a treat and an honor to have Dr. Ron Paul as our guest, not only because Ron is the worldwide leader of the freedom movement. I mean, that's a pretty great qualification, not only because he's such an interesting and important thinker, not only because he does a daily TV show, the Ron Paul Liberty Report, with Danny McAdams, who's the executive director of Iran's Institute for Peace and Prosperity. And I highly recommend everybody look at that show. And of course, we'll link to it. We'll link to Ron's Facebook page, his archive, and so forth. But Ron, am I right in thinking that this latest book of yours is your 14th book?
That sounds like a lot of books. I never sat down and counted them, but some are smaller than others. So I'm not going to go around bragging, oh, I've written 14 books. But there's been small books and pamphlets and things. And there's been a lot, but I haven't kept track.
Well, I can brag, and you've done a lot of very important books on many different subjects, from End the Fed, on the gold standard, and Challenge to Liberty, and your Revolution and Manifesto, and so forth. But I think your most recent book, and I know this is a tough judgment to make, I think it's your most important book, and it's a fascinating piece of reading as well. It's great when a book of important ideas is also both easy reading, compelling reading, fascinating reading, just draws you in and you can't put it down. And this, I'm talking about Swords into Plowshares, A Life in Wartime, and A Future of Peace and Prosperity. So, Ron, you know, there's no more, as Murray Rothbard said, there's never a more important political topic than the topic of war and peace, which you address so eloquently. But what's unusual about this book, and I would say unusual of all your books, it's so personal. I mean, it's almost like an autobiography in many senses, where you talk about your own life and war, your long fight for peace, what you're doing right now, and what you've always done. That's me talking. Why don't you tell us, why did you write Swords into Plowshares?
Of course, I tell people that when I started into politics, this wasn't the issue that I decided to speak out on. I wanted to speak out on financial, economic problems that we were having in the early 70s after the gold standard broke down.
No, and I remember.
I anticipated a lot of problems. So that's when I decided to speak out, when I spoke out in a political sense, and I ran for a political office, which was just a vehicle. So I really had no expectations. I was surprised that it eventually led into me being in office. But over the years, and that is what I describe in the book, that I became more and more interested in connecting the financial markets and the monetary system to foreign policy. I remember one time in the presidential debates, as the debate was opening up, they said, well, you guys up there talked about economic policy last week, and this week we're going to talk about foreign affairs. But I politely challenged, I said, you can't talk about one without the other, because if you talk about foreign affairs, you got to talk about economics as well. But it was my experience, and that's what I described with my first thoughts of war, because those were my earliest thoughts in my life. Being born in 35, my first memory was my youngest brother being born in 39. So I did remember things going on there, but throughout the war, it was constant, whether it was listening to the radio with my dad or selling butter in the dairy business, which was a home dairy business. We had to collect stamps, and there was a lot of collection of stamps in order to buy a war bomb. But that continued, and I just described it, you know, whether it was when I was in, grade school or high school, or what was going on in college, and how I was reflecting on it, both at the time and then going back and looking at these things. So I tell stories about how I reacted in World War II, then realizing, you know, that no, this rationing wasn't even necessary. It was dumb. It was doing the wrong thing once I studied and understood economics.
Although it was politically useful from a propaganda standpoint, wasn't it? I mean, even I would think even the government knew it wasn't necessary, but they thought it would gin up all the people to be involved in the war effort and to want to kill, kill, kill.
Yeah, I think it was psychological, because we would go to school and buy stamps and paste in the book and work it up to $18, and you had a $25. That's actually when they still paid interest instead of what we have today. No, it's psychological and rationing. You're always giving up something to be part of a heroic event, not realizing that, you know, as time goes on and you study this, you realize that World War II could have been averted if we would have had a wise foreign policy. But you have to go back all the way, you know, to World War One. And of course, if you talk like this, they say, "Oh, you won't even support World War II." But historically, there's been many who have written, and I know you're familiar with all of them, about a analysis of the lack of necessity of getting into World War One, and that Wilson has really provoked so much agony in the 20th century. Really, just one continuous war.
So, Ron, as you point out in your book, ever since the beginning of World War II, America has been at war pretty much every moment, and it's had a very bad effect politically, economically, socially. And you talk about this effect on you personally, as well as on the country, very, very eloquently in Swords into Plowshares.
Yes, and, you know, following World War II, the one thing they did with World War II and prior to that is they went through the format of a declaration of war, sort of getting consent from the people. And even that didn't prevent us from making very bad mistakes when the elites were determined to have war. The war propaganda is always so powerful. But if we look at it since World War II, the wars are more easily started. You know, the presidents can do it with an executive order. And you know, they don't declare war. They don't even pretend that there should be a restraint on war. So we just moved right into a period of time of constant wars, maybe not as big as World War I and World War II, but very damaging and very detrimental and lingering bad effects. Just think of the lingering bad effects from the Iraqi wars that have been going on recently. That's going to last for decades, taking care of the injured and into the trillions of dollars. And of course, the more we fight, as far as I'm concerned, the more vulnerable we are. I think the greater our danger, the less security we have. I just think that a goal for peace makes more sense than perpetual war. And yet right now, those who are in charge in Washington are the warmongers. The neoconservatives control both parties. Rhetoric changes a little bit. It just seems like regardless of which party's in power, our presence around the world will continue. And my theory is it'll continue until we go bankrupt and we'll have to leave these areas just like the Soviets had to leave when their system fell apart.
Ron, I remember back in your last presidential campaign, and somebody asked you, after you were critical of Obama, well, is there anything Obama's done that you're not critical of? And you said, well, he hasn't bombed Iran. So he still hasn't bombed Iran. And this latest peace agreement, while both of us think there are problems with it from the standpoint, I must say, of the Iranians, not the Americans, but nevertheless, it's happening. But despite all the neocons attacking it, and there's still a battle going on, of course. But I wonder to what extent you had an effect on that, because, you know, you've been the great spokesman for peace your whole life, but especially it's become much more of an issue to you and much more of an issue to people who love freedom and are concerned about their children and their grandchildren's futures and don't want them being sent off to kill and be killed. The fact that the American people didn't want to go to war in Syria, although Obama and the Republicans are wanting to do that all over again. Do you think that an increasing interest in peace by the American people, that maybe they're not quite so pro-warmongering, has had an effect on the fact that I think and hope they're not going to bomb Iran?
Well, I hope our efforts are coming around to helping a bit. But it's real hard to say. You know, I think public pressure stopped the bombing of Syria, you know, a couple of years ago when the pressure was on and there was a public expression that it didn't make any sense. But in a way, you know, there was an agreement this week between the Americans and the Turks to probably start bombing, you know, and get and expanding the war. So I think it's constant. But it might mean that if there's enough pressure and people have enough courage to stand up to it, maybe we'd have less war. And that's more or less one of my conclusions that I try to come to is, you know, we have a decent constitution. The founders tried hard to restrict the executive branch and the president from going to war. It hasn't worked. So it might depend on the people to just resist it. I think most people in the libertarian camp realized that public opinion is very, very important, that an attitude is important. If the people don't support certain governments, even bad dictators can run into trouble if they don't have some type of support. And right now, an encouraging thing for me is that to see that the foreign policy is failing and the people know it. The economic policies are failing. The Fed is failing. And therefore, it's a tremendous opportunity for us who have a different option. And it's in a good tradition of what America was supposed to be all about, you know, individual liberty and marketplaces and property rights and a gold standard. So it's not like we're inventing something new. But of course, the accusation that we hear from our opponents is, oh, you guys want to go back to the 18th century. But, you know, they're the ones who want to go back to ancient history. We've had dictators and authoritarians and inflation and debasement of currency and constant wars forever and ever. I would say that the most advanced cause would be to design and to promote an attitude where we recognize that peace is important. And I try to close my book with some optimism because, you know, I point out that the Industrial Revolution brought about unbelievable changes in the last 150 years, where standard of living skyrocketed for so many people. At the same time, much of that industrialization was used also to learn to kill each other. But at least there was a change. In 6,000 years of recorded history, most of the great things going on materialistic have been developed recently. Why can't human nature change once more and have a move for peace rather than just this war? Why don't we have a revolution for peace? I think it's conceivable because most people really want peace. It's when they get talked into this garbage from our leaders with all the propaganda. And now the best thing going on is the fact that people don't trust the government anymore. And it'd be nice if you could have only trustworthy people that are doing their best to protect our liberties. But right now, governments aren't designed for that. And every single day, it seems our government is attacking liberty. But it's a healthy sign to see so many people say, I don't even believe my government. And I think this is good because all we hear are the lies. You know, we're going to take care of you from cradle to grave, and they destroy the middle class. So we're going to bring you peace and security, and we're going to fight perpetual wars, and we've become, you know, less free and financially ruined. But this just puts more pressure on all of us who have, you know, a different opinion about what kind of a society we have and what the role of government ought to be.
Well, Ron, you certainly played such a magnificent role and continue to play such a magnificent role in the fight for economic freedom and civil liberties and for peace. I remember in one of your previous campaigns where you were talking to a bunch of evangelical warmongers in Washington, you said you worship the Prince of Peace, and they booed you. The Christian audience booed you because, of course, we're not supposed to remember what Jesus Christ said about war and about violence and about loving your enemies and doing good to other people, and that it's the peacemakers who are blessed, not the war makers. I can't thank you enough on behalf of everyone who cares about the cause of peace and against the mass murder of war, which is also, of course, the big benefit to government. Governments love wars. They do very well out of them, but, of course, the rest of us don't. Swords into Plowshares is such a great book. It's eloquent. It's such an easy read. It's a great book of history, of economics, of politics, of just everything combined. It's not long. It's about 230 pages long. All I can say is anybody who reads this, you're not going to forget it. You're going to be influenced for the rest of your life on what is the key issue of our time and maybe every time. Ron Paul, I think we all owe you another debt of gratitude for writing this book.
Well, thank you very much, Lou, and thank you for all your help over the years.
Great to talk to you today. Thank you. Well, thanks so much for listening to the Lou Rockwell Show today. Take a look at all the podcasts. There have been hundreds of them. There's a link on the LRC front page. Thank you.